Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We are here around the kitchen table right in the middle of downtown Ames at KHOI, the community radio station, right on Douglas Avenue off Main Street, underneath the Ames Pantorium sign. This place used to be a dry cleaner's, but now it is being put to much better use as a community radio station. Well, this is summer, and thanks to all the good rain, my garden is really taking off, especially the weeds. The weeds. I have never had such a bumper crop of purslane before.
And well, at least that's not a weed. That's a vegetable.
Actually, it is. A gardening friend of mine calls it the dreaded purslane, which is, that, you look at it and you think it is. It's low to the ground. It's succulent. It creeps and it grows like crazy and it's kind of all over the place. It's easy to pull. It is. And it grows fast, but it does choke out other things. So I've been busy.
I believe that it is reputed to be the only vegetable source of, wait a minute, one of the essential fatty acids or something? I've forgotten which one, but apparently it's very good for you.
Oh, it is. Actually, if you haven't tried purslane, and if you've got any sort of garden or know anybody else that does have sort of a garden, I just bet you could get a free sample this time of year. It's actually really good.
It's pretty easy. Yeah. You just pick one leaf off at a time.
Yeah.
And drop them into a salad. And they do have a slightly lemony flavor.
Yeah, they're succulent. They're good.
They're kind of nice. They have just a little nice textural element in the salad.
Yes.
But you could do it while you're watching TV or something. It's rather tedious.
Or just kind of when you're out in the garden, eat some of the stuff. Because I think that's one of the best revenges against this kind of weed. You can eat it. Also, in the Middle East, or actually maybe some other cultures too. You can eat it. I mean, it's used quite often. It is a thickener for stew, like okra.
Oh, if you cook them, do that?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And a friend from Turkey, Başak, gave me a recipe and actually made it for me once. Consider it as kind of an additive to a raita. Yogurt.
Now,
yogurt.
Did she put them in whole or did she chop them?
Yeah, but it was chopped up.
Yogurt, garlic, and purslane. A little salt and pepper.
Yeah, it seemed like there was maybe some parsley or something. It's some of the greeny thing in there. And, you know, kind of sets. So eating purslane is a good thing.
It's very delicious.
It is. But it does come way too fast, way too much. So
you got to eat a lot of it.
Yeah, my chickens they just kind of look at the pile now. We don't want any more for a while.
Those picky chickens.
But thanks to all the good rain, anyway, I'd rather have weeds and rain.
We don't mind this problem.
It's just fine.
Yeah. I was reading about the grounded planes in like Phoenix because it's too hot for the airplanes to fly.
Too hot for airplanes to fly.
Yeah. The West Coast is having a terrible time, and we are sitting pretty here, as
we
it were.
Are.
It's like perfect weather.
Good. Oh, well, let's enjoy this nice weather out here. The solstice happened. Yes.
Is it today?
Oh, no, the solstice is actually tomorrow, isn't it?
It's tomorrow. I haven't looked it up the exact day.
The 21st, yes, it is.
It's coming.
Yeah, it is.
It's the longest day of the year.
Very good.
I have to say, part of my brain feels like once the solstice arrived, it goes like, okay, it's all downhill after this.
Oh, that's a long downhill.
I know. It's okay. The solstice is today, according to Evan. Okay. So be solsticing out there. It's a good day for a solstice. So here we have the longest day of the year. So everybody stay up and watch the sunset. You can even get up and watch the sun rise tomorrow morning if you want to do the whole thing.
Very good.
Yes,
and it
is every day from now on until December 21st or thereabouts. We'll have less sunlight per day.
Oh,
I know. We're heading into the darkness again. What can you do?
We'll enjoy.
Yes.
Today on the Donalana Kitchen, we're going to be talking about cherries and pitting those darn cherries.
Oh,
and
cherries.
And also, we've got a report from our man in the field, Nick Odey. He has a practical farmer to introduce us to. And we've got a few news items, too. One of the favorite tastes of summer is cherries, and they happen
quick. Life is just a bowl of cherries?
It is a cherry-bowlies.
I don't know where that came from, but we can really appreciate it this year. This is a great cherry year. We may have screwed up with the strawberries, but the cherries are coming on strong.
Oh, yes. There's all kinds of different cherries, and, ones that grow really well here in Iowa, in the Midwest, are the more sour kind, the pie cherries, we like to call them.
I have
them.
A personal rant yeah. about the cherries of the last 20 or 30 or 40 years. When I was a kid, mostly we had pie cherries, right, which I love. Mm-hmm. But then came the great amount of Bings and Queen Anne's, and, you know, if you go to the grocery store now to buy cherries, you will not find the real cherries.
That's true.
You cannot really buy tart cherries in the store.
The sweet ones are the ones
that's
that have
all
taken
you,
over.
That's all you can... I mean, and I'm not saying I don't like sweet cherries, but these little... And Lana came in with a little bowl that she just picked right, or Joe picked right off the tree today, and I have a tree, and anybody who has room for a tree in Iowa should have a sour cherry tree.
Yes.
Or a pie cherry.
Let's call it a pie cherry. We've got a tree called North Star, and probably a lot of you have a North Star or something similar in mm-hmm. the backyard. They are a cherry that has sort of, when it ripens, it's red on the inside. There's others, like the Montmorency, that also ripen and taste lovely, but they're kind of goldish, golden on the inside.
And they're still the tart. Kind,
tart,
right?
Tart, yep, very tart, very
right,
nice.
So this North Star is kind of what I would call the classic, right?
It makes a really pretty pie. One of the tricky things about having a cherry tree is to beat the chipmunks and birds it.
Oh, yeah.
We had such a bountiful harvest this week, and it's still going on, that I think we came out about even. I mean, I think maybe all the folks, all the little winged
the
ones and the woodland
yes.
folks have got their fill, and we have too. I see little chipmunks going around with little fat cheeks, but we've got plenty. We've got plenty. I let my husband loves to do fuss with the cherry trees, climbing the ladders and getting the pits out. And
aren't you lucky?
I am. I like. Yeah, it's good. It's good. What's my favorite things that you like to do with cherries?
Well, the lazy person's thing to do with cherries, which I've been doing this week, is because I have a very young tree and I don't get much off of it, but you just put them in a canning jar, and you pour brandy over them. And you screw that. You fill it up to the top. You screw the lid on, and you let it sit in the pantry. And they're great for Christmas. I mean, a couple of months is enough, but you don't have to pit them. So I put, instead of just straight brandy, I actually put B&B, which is Benedictine in brandy, which is slightly... let's say it's a little more velvety. It's got a little sweetener. It's more viscous, and OMG, when those are ready, you know, like you might drop a couple in a beverage, a cold beverage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even a glass of seltzer water with a spritz of lemon in it, and you drop a couple cherries in it, or a cocktail, of course. That's the lazy person's
Yes, it's not
version.
Too early to think about Christmas and those toddies and those little cordials.
And you leave the pit in because actually it flavors it as well.
Ah, very good. Very good. Well, I made a pie this weekend just because pies are good, and I do like cherry pies. I use the Joy of Cooking pie recipe, and I have to force myself to follow recipes because I tend to make things up. And pies, you want to at least make sure that the fruit sets and doesn't run all over the place. So I actually measured this. Also,
what do they call for? Tapioca or cornstarch or flour?
They recommended either tapioca or cornstarch. I didn't have enough tapioca, so I used cornstarch. Mm-hmm. And letting the cornstarch and a little bit of sugar set on the fruit for a good 15 minutes so it all gets soaked in.
And a good trick is to mix the cornstarch and the sugar first.
Yes.
Because that breaks up the lumps and disperses it more evenly.
That's good. Oh, also, another thing to add, according to the Joy of Cooking, a couple drops of almond extract.
Yes, that is is absolute classic.
Almond extract.
Not too much.
No.
You don't want to eat the pie and go, oh, this has almond extract in it. It's just enough to blend in with the cherry flavor.
It's a good combination. The cherry pie didn't last too long. It went real quick, so it must have been a big hit.
What'd you make the crust out of?
Half spelt flour, half whole wheat flour, and half lard and half butter.
Ooh, lard and butter. Ooh.
Made it all lard, but I didn't take out enough out of the freezer, and we can't go wrong with butter. Oh, Donna, I wanted to ask you too. Another thing about that cherry pie recipe, and I find this in other fruit recipes, it always says before you put the crust on the top, dot with butter. You're supposed to dot the fruit that you've poured into the crust. Why dot with butter?
There's no reason except for the richness of the flavor. Fruits, of course, have no fats in them, and then the fat that you put in the crust, you know, stays emulsified in the grain, so it doesn't really go into the fruit mixture. So if you put the butter on the top as it thickens, you know, the juices cook with the cornstarch or the whatever, the butter melts into it and becomes part of the runny, you know, the runny part of the pie.
That's the runny really bits, yeah.
That's the best. So as my mother would say, it's like throwing in the tail with the hide.
Oh, okay.
It, you know, just add it in because why not?
I always do. I mean, what? I just add more butter. Okay. I was thinking maybe there was a chemical thing that had.
It's a taste. I mean, okay, fat, any kind of fat, mm-hmm. is a, quote, flavor carrier.
Aha. Uh-huh.
That, you know, when you get down to the chemistry of it, they will kind of claim that fat itself does not have a flavor. Mm. I mean, obviously the olive oil flavor comes from some element in the olive that goes into the oil. The butter flavor comes from, like, the little bits of the milk particles that are still in the butter. So flavor, any oil is actually a flavor carrier. So it just kind of like, it's like why you put a tiny, tiny little bit of salt into something that's sweet, because it just kind of goes ding with the flavor. Just ups that volume of the flavor a tiny little bit.
Well, I will keep doing it because adding butter was really good.
Cherries
are wonderful, but they have this aspect to them that one must deal with. They come with pits. They come with little stones in the middle. Okay, let's talk about getting those little suckers pitted, okay?
Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Well, there's the old unfurl the paper clip and poke them through one by one.
Ugh.
Yeah.
That takes forever. You get kind of sticky doing that.
Yeah. And did you tell me Joe has a method of using a plastic straw?
We practiced with some variations on a theme this weekend, putting a pop bottle or a beer bottle and balancing the cherry on top, glass one, mm-hmm. and poking through with a straw. He says, yeah, it works just fine. The seed drops into the bottle. The cherry, unless it's teeny tiny, stays on top. But that's one of those.
And the juice goes dribbling all the way down the bottle.
And the juice goes dribbling all the way down the bottle. That's one of those that it's one at a time. One at a time. And you need a lot of cherries for a cherry pie.
Well, you know, we've gotten modern and impatient, I'm afraid, right?
Yes, we did.
So Lana and I each brought our cherry pitters into the studio here, and we need television for this, but we're going to try our best to describe these experiences. So My cherry picker, and I must say I'm not a prolific cherry picker for obvious reasons. Okay, I found it at the Wilson Auction in Cole Oak, where often I'm the only person buying these culinary antiques, let's say. So, you know, this one said, it says New Standard Mount Joy, Pennsylvania, and it's a contraption made out of cast aluminum, and it's from the period where they still had those green wooden handles on everything. So I'm guessing it's got to be, oh, maybe 75 to 100 years. It's old. It's old. But this is what, hear that noise? I'm cranking the handle. So it has a little sort of cup kind of thing, and you put the, apparently it's angled so that, you know, let's see, I could put maybe 15 cherries on it, right? Oh, boy. Let's line it up, Lana, and see what happens. Oh, no. Oh, wait a minute. We need two containers. Okay. All right. So it has a little thing. You turn the handle, and let's see. Okay. Here we go. It presses down. Ooh, it's working, Lana.
It picks up a cherry.
Yeah, it picks, it has a little sharp thing that has a, it's like a four-pointed star. So it pierces the cherry. Oh, wait, I'm going backwards. It pierces the cherry. It pushes the pits out. And then as it draws up, the cherry spits off into the bowl. Oh, Lana, let's see how fast it will go. Oops, uh-oh. I've already, all right, this pit is not, oh, shoot, that one went on the floor. Okay, all right, it's working. Oops. Lana, they're jumping off the oops, come on.
I think in the history of cherry pitters, This is the problem. It goes all over the place.
Well, but you know what? I've had other old ones that are messier than this one, I have to say. This is relatively, efficient. Okay, so I just pitted maybe 10 cherries, okay?
Not counting the three that hit the floor.
Yeah, but good job. I have cherry juice all over my dress. And then there's two more on the floor. Okay, now Lana has a more newfangled contraption.
We wanted to see what was the latest in cherry pitters. I mean, there had to be something between pop bottle with a straw. And these old ones are great. They look like Rube Goldberg contraptions.
Yeah, I could live with this one if
this
I had
one, it's
to.
Okay. It's okay. Ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk. Because nothing's worse than biting into a cherry pit in a pie. You still may get a cherry pit. Talk to the fine folks at Cook's Emporium and said, what's the latest?
We have been relying on Marg lately quite a bit.
What's the latest in cherry pit technology? And there is a company called Victorio, and they make a lot of kitchen products, a lot of nice kitchen products. The inventors at Victorio evidently took the old technology and moved it one notch ahead, because
it's plastic, for one thing.
It's really heavy-duty plastic. One nice thing about it, it's gotten one of these suction cups that sucks it right to the counter. Good job.
And then, yeah, mine is clamped to the counter. Yeah.
They've also worked out the little tray, and you can, Donna's, you don't have to do one at a time, but.
All right, I'm going to take mine off. We're going to try Lana's.
All right.
Wait till you hear. Wait, Lana, you better do this, because lots of sound effects today,
I didn't
folks.
Do it. One of the strange things about this is that you do have to follow the directions. It's got, like, not many parts, but it does have parts.
Oops. Is this the kind where you have to spit on the bottom to make the suction stick? Yeah. Oh, it's a little. All right.
This one has a little pit pocket already.
The container underneath it. Okay.
However, it doesn't have many parts at all, and of course it came with directions, but it's real easy when you put it together to forget one of the parts. So even with this nice new cherry pitter, I ended up with a mess a couple times until I decided to go back and read the directions.
Yeah,
here we go.
Follow the directions. Okay.
So,
okay. Oops. Okay. Same problem as mine. The container that slants them in, you still have to use your fingers. Okay. You know what? Actually, the principle of it is not too different. It has the same. Oh, look at Lana, the cutter blade.
Mm-hmm. Same thing.
Same.
A little
four-shape. Four-point thing.
So technology does come to our rescue. Yes, it does.
Oh, I like this one.
Yeah, it is nice. It does suck. Yeah, it sucks to my kind.
Hey, that sure beats the So poking them one at a time.
Yeah, so the concept of one at a time, at least we have...
Plus, none of them jumped out of the tray, and none of them got on my dress. Okay, 5 stars out of 5 for the Victorio.
Very good, Victorio.
All right.
And like I said, they make other sort of handy kitchen things.
Oh, yeah, I think I have some... I have their grain mill. Mm-hmm. Oh, and of course, the apple corer. That's famous.
Another fruit thing.
Yeah.
Good. It says on the...
Apple peeler.
Information from the Victoria people that the company is out in Utah someplace. So it's a sort of a semi-American thing.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know where they outsource things, but that's where they say it is. So there it is. Okay. That's good. So how to get the pits out? Oh, my goodness. Oh, yes.
It's worth it. That's all I can say. It's worth
people it. People do like their cherry pies. There are different areas in the country where cherries are a big deal, are a commercial crop.
Did we mention they're good for you?
Oh, talk about how good they are.
Okay. Well, they truly are, of course, like many fruits, but even more than some. They are loaded with antioxidants. They are good for gout.
Gout! Do we have gout yet? What's gout?
It's something where your feet swell.
Is it like
or something?
Arthritis? Maybe something.
No, it's different from arthritis. But apparently cherries are good for all sorts of inflammation. In fact, I noticed the last time I was in California, I was at a Whole Foods store and they were selling tart cherry juice strictly as a supplement, a dietary supplement for its medicinal uses.
Huh.
We'll have more on that later.
Cherries are good for you. Well, getting back to people kind of get competitive here. Yeah, you know, and there's commercial cherry growing areas. Wisconsin.
All right. Upper Michigan.
Upper Michigan is famous. And Washington State. And so, of course, you get together, you got to say the world's largest cherry pie. Okay. So in 1976, a town called Charlevoix. They probably say it different in Michigan. Charlevoix, Charlevoix. Close to the heart of the cherry growing area by Lake Michigan. Put together, well, now this took a special pan, a special oven. They baked a pie weighing 17,420 pounds. I know, Donna's mouth just opens up. Okay. Now, I have a feeling.
I hope the town was big enough to eat the whole thing.
You know, Cherry Festival. Okay.
That's a
11
lot.
11 years later, in 1987, this town of Traverse City, Michigan.
Very famous for their cherries, right?
Had its own Cherry Festival, and they made one that was 28,000 pounds. This is silly. So it must have been like a football-sized... long, you know, a big pan, something or other.
They baked it in pans and glued it together with cornstarch.
Oh, my goodness. It was a diameter of 17 and a half feet. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Now, there must have been, like, some guys involved in this, a little bit of competition, because out in British Columbia, the little town of Oliver, in 1992, jumped into it and produced a cherry pie that weighed 39,683 pounds.
I'm sorry. Let's put those guys back to grilling. I like the old-fashioned 8-inch pie. I can eat the whole thing myself.
I like that, too. A world's largest cherry pie.
People with too much time on their hands, maybe.
It is. But... you know, if you got cherries as a commercial crop, maybe you kind of overdo it.
Maybe just for the sheer joy of community effort. That in itself is
it's kind of like the
fun.
Super Bowl. Boy, somebody had to pit all those. Oh, dear.
I bet in Traverse City they have some kind of machine.
Oh, I bet they
huge
do,
Huge industrial
I bet
thing.
They do
that,
too.
Right, because, yeah. Yeah, right. Okay.
World's largest cherry pie. And I also found out that in 1912... was when the governor of the city of Tokyo brought the cherry trees to Washington, D.C.
The famous Washington D.C. But I don't know, do those cherry trees in Washington actually make cherries?
I have no idea. They make a big deal out of the blooms. I thought somebody...
Do you suppose... Now, wasn't it the cherry tree that Washington chopped down and said, I cannot tell a lie?
That's true.
See, right. Oh, this is Cherry Cultural History.
Cherry Cultural History. There it is. There it is. Ah, cherries. You are listening to KHOI. This is community radio, and it's well worthy of your support. And this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. This is tart and tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. A little update on those famous cherry trees.
The cherry blossoms
in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, right. So Evan has looked it up, and we find out that, lo and behold, the cherry trees in Washington are purely ornamental. It's a different, what did you say, variety? It's a different something?
Yeah, what I learned is that the cherry blossom trees and the cherry fruit trees actually come from different families within the plant kingdom. So these aren't even meant to produce fruit. They're just meant to look pretty.
Go figure. In Washington, D.C., they're growing cherry trees that are non-productive and only look good. Hello? Is there a parallel here?
I don't know.
I'm not one to draw conclusions. However, having purely ornamental cherry trees seems like a huge waste of time to me.
It does.
Because ours bloom. They look gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And then
we have cherries.
Yeah, but we're industrious and we have to pick and pit them. Maybe that would be too much in Washington, D.C.
Well, they have pages out there and assistants, aides, you know, people. Anyway.
Yeah, well.
Encourage them to put in something you can eat. It's good to have something.
Yeah, a little urban farming out there in Washington, D.C.
Well, something else that goes on this time of year, as the nights warm up, and if you're in a place where there's not a whole lot of street lights, you may be enjoying fireflies this time of year. Ladybugs, fireflies, same thing.
No, not ladybugs.
Lightning bugs when I was little.
Yeah, I grew up calling them.
But
all the English literature always calls them fireflies.
Okay, so let's call them fireflies.
No, I think we should stick with lightning bugs. Let's be true to our roots.
Anyway,
it's a good year for lightning bugs.
They're
too
out there. It's
more
a
than
beautiful,
usual. I've
beautiful seen. Evening. Yes,
mm-hmm.
It is. What a nice thing to celebrate. And I have a poem here, short poem from the poet Robert Frost. He talks about fireflies in the garden. And they're all out there doing their best. Heaven knows what they're doing out there, but they're blinking away. And here's the poem from Robert Frost, Fireflies in the Garden. Here come the real stars to fill the upper sky, and here on earth come the emulating flies, that though they never equal stars in size, and they were never really stars at heart, achieve at times a very star-like start. Only, of course, they can't sustain the part. There we go. Little fireflies out there, they're ephemeral, they don't last long, but they have, I'm sure they have lovely lives.
But didn't you used to chase them and catch them in a jelly jar and watch them glow and And then, of course, you have to turn them loose before they die, or that would be a travesty.
Well, right. Anyway, that was a poem by Robert Frost. All right. Some of you might have lightning bugs or fireflies in your backyard, or you might have a cherry tree or an apple tree.
You could have both, or all three.
Yeah. Or maybe even a tomato plant in your backyard. You know, food comes not from big industrial spaces
far away from home. That's ethanol that comes from the bee.
But the dirt under our feet, even in your backyard, you might have a tree. You can grow a tree.
I'm going to stick in a little thing that I read recently, that somebody has run a statistical analysis that says, you know how we're always saying we have to, especially here in Iowa, we have to feed the world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turns out that, of course, it's not corn that feeds the world, but what would feed the world or be more effective in feeding the world is to offer more birth control.
I like that.
Yeah.
There we go.
Okay, just think that one through a little bit, okay?
All right.
That's the feminist perspective. What do the women do? They don't grow more corn. They manage the size of their family so the fruit goes further on the planet.
Right.
How about that?
And then their cherry tree doesn't have to be 15,000 pounds of cherries.
Right.
It can just be one for one
family. One pie for a family.
Yeah.
Or two if we're really greedy, right?
Right. So thinking of backyards and gardens, we have a report here from our man in the field, Nick Odey, talked to a practical farmer about making a living and starting a farm in the city. It's an urban farm. Nick Odey, take it away.
This week on the show, we have John Yagla of the Millet Seed Farm in Iowa City. With his partner, Ren, John runs an urban farm that consists of a series of garden beds in various backyards and front yards around his neighborhood. Combined, he figures they add up to about a fifth of an acre. And on that tiny space, they grow enough vegetables to feed a 20-person CSA.
I think the big key has just been reducing expenses, and that's just something I'm passionate about, is trying to spend less money and participate less in the economy. I mean, I still do a lot, obviously, but we're just pretty frugal over here, and, you know, this farming comes just my half. Ren has a job that covers her half, and also I've been thinking about this stuff for a while. I've had some savings that was expected to be somewhere else, so I have a cushion if something happens. And I've, you know, slowly been building up infrastructure, and we don't need a ton of infrastructure, so it's just kind of, everything's kind of fallen into place over the past 8 or 9 years as I've been, like, learning about farming and continuing to do this work and learn ways to live on less.
On June 24th, they'll be hosting a field day, sharing their experience with operating a small-scale, full-time urban farm. John and Ren will lead a tour of their plots, talk about their no-till system, discuss their unique neighborhood-focused CSA model, and share some details about business planning and financial goals. So, you only have about a fifth of an acre that you grow your vegetables on. How big is that? Is that like a big lawn, or what kind of size are we talking about?
Well, I've got 5 or 6 garden plots spread out throughout the neighborhood where I live. And I have one that is about 3 miles away, just south of town. Most of my beds are 100 square feet, which is, they're 25 feet long and 4 feet wide. And let's see, I think I have between 60 and 70 of those beds, not including the pathways. And so I just did some calculations to figure out what the acreage was, and I was actually surprised it was so small because it feels like a lot. But that's probably because I'm doing most of the stuff with hand tools and whatnot.
So it's the plots and beds are spread out throughout the neighborhood. How does that work? How'd you get started with that?
Yeah, so I'm actually living in the neighborhood with my partner, Ren, where I grew up. And I started gardening one of these plots before I started the farm. And it was actually when I was just getting into farming. I went up to my neighbor, who I actually didn't know her that well, and just asked her if I could garden this lot. It was a corner lot that was all grass. And this, to answer the first question, that this might help people a little bit. This corner lot's 50 by 50 approximately. And I'd say that's in, like, I have four plots, and that's about four plots that are bigger that are around 50 by 50 or like 50 by 75. And then I have a couple smaller ones that are just like 25 by 25.
So you started on that first one. So how'd you expand to the other ones?
Well, really, Ren and I ended up buying a house just down the street from my parents, which is really close. I can see the corner lot garden from across the street, and we started gardening. At this point, I had actually just taken a break from farming, was doing construction. I wanted to learn some skills, some homesteading skills around building, and so I was taking a break from farming. That was right after the 2012 drought year, and so started digging up the backyard and just had those two garden plots until I decided I wanted to try the urban farming, and some friends kind of helped push me in that direction. I was hesitant to do it because we'd actually tried a while back to obtain some other yards with difficulties. I just asked around, again, some neighbors that had big yards, and they said yes. So kind of went at it. And so, like, last year I had four, and this year I added my parents' front yard, and my neighbor across the street has a small plot that he gave to me, and we also turned the front yard into production beds, which before was kind of just a wild area.
So where'd you get the idea to start doing this?
I just have been really interested in gardening and growing food for ourselves primarily, and thought I wanted to farm for a while. I was actually I'd been saving money, hoping to get land, and land prices just continued to increase, and it became clear that I would have to go into a lot of debt to acquire some farm ground outside of town, and this just seemed like an opportunity to be able to grow and sell food on a small scale, and I really was ready to be done with construction work and try the farming.
So what are your favorite things to grow? We were talking before we went on air here about that you're planting some broccoli today, but that's maybe not your favorite thing to grow. What's some of your favorite things to grow?
Yeah. Ren was planting the broccoli. That was her project. I'm excited. I hope it works out, but broccoli's not my favorite thing to grow. I love growing alliums. Like, that's probably my favorite. So any onion, garlic, leeks. I love growing leeks. And I especially am fond right now of the Egyptian walking onions, and they're a perennial onion that have just lots of potential in different ways. I'm still learning about them, but I use them, plant them in the fall like garlic, which is why I love them. It's a lot less labor than starting onions and leeks in February inside, and I start harvesting them, you know, right away in the spring as green onions, and then now that they have their onion sets forming on the top, the stalks are tough, but you can still utilize the plant as long as you cut that stalk out, and then they'll also produce like a shallot-like bulb, and hopefully that's a substantial size. I'm still kind of trying to figure out how to use Egyptian walking onions from market garden perspective.
So how does that, so then the bulb, I mean, after you plant it in the fall, then it just keeps coming? How does that work?
I kind of treat it like garlic or a biennial, where I harvest, so it forms small onion sets on the top, and they usually fall over and plant themselves, but what I do is I harvest those, and I select the largest for my seed stock, and then I plant those out in the fall. And so I save back a certain percentage for seed each year and kind of calculate that into my planting.
So do you, Do you like to eat the walking onion?
Yeah, I love them. I actually just had some for lunch today. I made up an Indian dish with some of our black-eyed peas and walking onions and garlic steaks.
That sounds delicious. So what is it? Do you use it more like a green onion or more? How do you use it in general?
At this point, when they're young and tender, I use it as a green onion. It has a little sharper, spicier onion flavor than like a scallion or what you'd get at the grocery store. But at this point, they're really strong. The tops, they're spicy. So I just use it like a regular onion at the beginning. Stir fry, cook it in some oil with some spices for a little bit until it softens up.
I suppose you have lots of different neighbors since you have these beds in different yards around your neighborhood. What do your neighbors think of the of your project?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think everybody's really excited about it. At least that's all we've heard. We haven't had anybody call and complain about the piles of junk in the driveway, luckily. And we get a lot of positive comments about it. And we've also been in the neighborhood. I mean, I grew up here, so I've been here for almost 33 years. We know a lot of the neighbors. And it's just exciting. And there's a lot of our neighbors, as people will see if they come to the field, they also have gardens. And it's just cool, little quiet dead-end street. It's a nice place to be.
You listen to KHOI. That was an interview by Nick Odie with urban farmer John Yagla from Iowa City, growing a lot of things right in the old backyard. Not just his backyard, but lots of others, too. For more information on Practical Farmers, go to practicalfarmers.com. For more information on field days are happening. And you can go to give Deborah Buchholder a call.
Right, and their field day for this particular farmer is June 24th.
That's coming right
up. If you want to go and see the whole thing.
That's Deborah at practicalfarmers.org. Welcome back to the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was a English country dance tune. Kind of fits the weather, doesn't it? It's just a wonderful summery sort of feeling. That tune was called Money in Both Pockets. a good wish for all the farmers out
happy
there.
Happy country people there.
Oh, very good. Money in Both Pockets, yes. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. If you want to find out more about the Donalana Kitchen, you can go to khoifm.org. That is the website for this fine community radio station. And on that website, you will find lots of other shows besides our wonderful show. There's lots of locally produced things, stuff from the National Network. We just keep you informed on all sorts of things. So you can go to khoifm.org, go to the talk section, and you'll find out lots of other locally produced talk things too, and find the Donalana Kitchen, and click on that, and you can find that we have got all of our shows archived. If you can't get enough of this program, if you can't get enough of Donalana Kitchen talking at you, then you can listen to old shows. We go back, what, 3.5 years?
Yeah, no. More than 3 years.
Oh, so there's more stuff than you
Lonnie
could.
And I can talk. Well, we've been talking for three years.
Going. Mm. And people like to talk about food. And there's a recipe page. And I think there's even a picture of Donna and I there. Yes, there is. Yes, there is. So support this fine radio station because this radio station, unlike a lot of other businesses, a lot of other media, this is community supported. This is supported by, run by, governed by,
programmed by
people in the community. So if you don't like what's on the radio, come on in and make your own darn show. We'd love to have you come in and meet us. So, KHOI Radio.
Now we are going to have a KHOI 5-year birthday.
Coming up in?
It's August 12th is the date of the event. There's going to be live music in the studio. There's going to be a band in the street. There's going to be some children's choirs, some all kinds of. And the Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsoring the cake potluck.
I think that's a really good invention, Donna. Tell us about the cake potluck.
Well, we sort of made it up ourselves. It's the usual potluck theory, but not for dinner. It's only cakes because it's a birthday party.
Oh, everybody's got an opinion on cakes, I'm sure.
Well, this is your chance to make your favorite cake recipe and show it off in public where it will be appreciated. I'm sure we'll have a little commentary about the kinds of cakes, mentioning, of course, the makers of the cakes, if you want to be famous in the community for 30 seconds. What kind of cake are you thinking of making, Lana?
Oh, I've got so many. I'm going to have to kind of dig around and see what I can come up with. There's a chocolate stout cake that was really good. But anyway, traditionally, when I was a kid, I had family would make a angel food cake, and I only wanted it for birthdays. Angel food cake, and it had those little sprinkles in it. The ones, the little colors.
You know, it was my father's favorite. He loved angel food cake, and so rather than doing the boxed mix, which I always abhor, I made one from scratch. And you know what? It was not that difficult. It really was kind of fun.
Egg whites.
Yes. And the opposite of the angel food cake, which I may make, is the lard pound cake.
Oh, you've got the high and mighty or the dense. Oh, very
from
good.
One extreme to the other.
See, we're already thinking about cake for the birthday. Stay tuned.
Yes, and anybody is welcome. Give us a call at the radio and say, oh, I'd like to bring in a cake. And now we've got plenty of time.
Yeah.
It's August 12th. So kind of put it in your radar and think about, you know, that might be kind of fun.
It just
calling
might
all
be.
Cake makers.
Calling
August
all
12th.
Cake. Very good.
The cake potluck for the KHOI 5th birthday party.
Very good.
And you don't have to put candles on it.
No. It's kind of implied. Yes,
yeah.
It is. So, Donna, you have a few news items from the Donalana Kitchen
news
desk.
Oh, yes. There were a couple of things that came across on the food blogs this week. The first one is that there was a ruling in the European Union that, and this is being discussed in this country also, it's the Dairy Association or something or other, is claiming that the dairy terminologies like cheese and milk and butter are being co-opted by products that have in fact, no dairy in them. So in the European Union, they have ruled that this is inadmissible or not permissible. Or anyway, so they will no longer be having soy milk. They will be having soy beverage or soy drink. They will no longer be having tofu cheese. It will be tofu spread. Now, I wonder if that is going to affect tofurkey.
Oh,
that's kind of a little.
Oh, there's another lobby.
Yeah, that's the turkey lobby, I suppose.
And let's figure out what they're going to call peanut butter.
Oh, goodness. Peanut spread.
Oh,
I have to look up the French word for peanut butter and see what they're doing on that one. Oh,
butter do peanut.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
So, and the other bit of news, this was a very funny, there was some kind of sociological, scientific nutritionists got together and they did a survey to figure out what attracts people to eating certain ways. So they made up, you know, descriptors, and it turns out if the descriptor for something is, this is really good for you, people are not interested. If it's, even if it's, this might help you lose weight, they're not interested.
Oh, really?
They were, I think, basically trying to figure out how to get people to eat more vegetables. But obviously, they did find out, and this is science, this is real science, they found out if they write a descriptor for a dish that includes, you know, kind of adjectives of embellishment or something, you know, like these green beans were a particular variety and they were sauteed gently with lovage and basil, and you know, if they make this elaborate description of what the dish is, 45% more people will choose it.
Well, that's a kind of a no-brainer.
We
eat not just with our noses or with actually.
It's an emotional choice, I do believe.
I think it's very emotional.
Yeah, it is not irrational. Yeah. Now, here's another thing that the same article said. Now, sit down, folks. This one knocked my socks off, okay? It is now scientifically proven that 7% of American adults believe, are you ready for this, Lana? They believe that chocolate milk comes from brown cows. But that's 7%. That's not children. That's adults. So we are generally, I believe, rather uninformed about food.
Oh goodness.
And chocolate milk in particular.
Are these?
And that's not chocolate soy milk. That's chocolate milk, right?
Well, that would be one way to keep it separate. You know, you got your white cows and your brown cows. No, that's not how it works.
So what do those big black and white cows give then?
Oreos. They
Gray
make
milk.
Oreos. They make the Oreos. Yeah. That's how to do that.
Okay.
Very good.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Well, but there's also the theory on if the world is flat or not. We're still working on that one, I'm afraid.
Well, if you walk far enough, you'll know that it's flat. I mean, after you go over the mountains. Of course.
Yes, it is. So what we eat has much to do with, I think our hopes and dreams and our imaginations and our creativity.
But we like the cherries. We can't find any fault with the cherries.
We can't find fault with cherries. And those that don't like sour cherries, you're going to put more sugar in than I would. But that's okay. I like the sour cherries. So get yourself a cherry tree. North Star cherry trees. I think we planted ours about 12 years ago. And it's doing pretty darn good now, even though we do share with the chipmunks. Don't mind that at all. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen today. And today we talked about cherries. The pits of cherries.
The pitters.
Fireflies, an urban farm. Thanks to Nick Odey of Practical Farmers of Iowa for bringing us that fine interview. We had music today, English country dance music by Liz Donaldson, Becky Ross, and Colleen Reed. We'll go out with a tune called Take a Dance. Oh, there's a barn dance this weekend, so do take a dance. Yes, thanks for joining us at our kitchen table. We're on the air Tuesdays at noon and 7 p.m. or anytime. Stream, download, anything that you can do with your device there at khoyfm.org. Get out and pick those cherries. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had excellent engineering, as usual, by Evan Taylor.
And fact-checking by Evan Taylor.
Of course. Eat good food and enjoy life.